Chapter 29. Francis. It was nearly 3 p.m. as Francis made her way with some eagerness downstairs to the meditation studio for the breaking of the silence. She hadn't eaten anything solid since the night before, and she was very hungry. When the breakfast and midday bells had rung today, Francis had gone to the dining room to find a row of smoothies set out on the sideboard, labelled by name. Francis had found hers and tried to drink it slowly and mindfully, but it was gone before she knew it, and her stomach had begun to rumble, loudly and embarrassingly. She was not really starving, but she was yearning. Not so much for food, but for the ritual of food. Maybe if she'd been at home, running around doing errands, it would be easy to skip a few meals. Not that she ever did. She'd always had difficulty comprehending the phrase, "I forgot to eat lunch." But here, especially during the silence, meals were crucial to break up the day. She tried to distract herself by reading in the hammock, but her book had taken an outlandish turn, which she couldn't handle on an empty stomach. Her spirits lifted when she walked into the studio. The lights had been turned off, and the room was illuminated by clusters of flickering candles. It was cool down here. Some sort of essential oil burner was pumping out a heady mist, and spine-tingling music was being piped through invisible speakers. Frances always appreciated a little effort when it came to ambience. She noted low, camp-like beds had been set out around the sides of the room with blankets and pillows. Headphones and eye masks were laid out on the pillows with water bottles alongside, like business-class seats thoughtfully arranged for a long-haul flight. Marcia, Yao, and Delilah sat cross-legged in the middle of the room, along with the three members of the Marconi family and the tall, dark, and handsome man. "Welcome. Please join this circle," Marcia said, as more people filed into the room behind Francis. Marcia wore a long, white, sleeveless satin and lace dress, somewhere between a wedding dress and a nightgown. She'd made up her eyes so that they were even more prominent. Yao and Delilah, extremely attractive young people, looked almost ordinary and washed out next to this celestial being. Within a few moments, everyone was there. Francis was seated with Heather on one side and young Ben on the other. She wondered how Ben was feeling. Probably missing his car. She studied his tanned, hairy leg in the candlelight. Not in a sexual way, thank the Lord, just in a kind of fascinated way, because all this silent, mindful meditating over the last few days made everything fascinating. Each individual hair on Ben's leg was like a tiny tree in a dear little forest. Ben cleared his throat and shifted his leg. Francis straightened and met the eyes of the tall, dark, and handsome man seated on the opposite side of the circle. He sat straight-backed and solemn, yet somehow in a manner that conveyed he wasn't taking any of this too seriously. She automatically went to look away, but he held her gaze and winked. Francis winked back, and he looked startled. She was a terrible winker. She found it hard to close only one eye and had been told that her attempt looked like an extraordinary facial spasm. "And so we come to the end of our noble silence," said Marcia. She grinned and punched the air. "We did it!" Nobody said a word, but there was a gentle murmur of sound, exhalations, the shifting of bodies, and half-chuckles of acknowledgement. I'd like us to now slowly reintroduce conversation and eye contact, said Masha. We shall each take a turn to introduce ourselves and speak for just a few moments about whatever comes to mind. Perhaps why you chose to come to Tranquillum House, what you're enjoying most about your experience so far, and what you found most challenging. Are you dying for a cappuccino or a glass of Sauvignon Blanc? I get it. Share your pain with the group. Are you missing a loved one? Tell us about that. Or maybe you just prefer to deliver straight up facts. Your age, your occupation, your hobbies, your star sign. Masha smiled her extraordinary smile, and everyone smiled back. Or recite a line of poetry, if you like, she continued. It doesn't matter what you say. Simply enjoy the experience of speaking, connecting, and making eye contact with your fellow guests. People cleared their throats, adjusted their posture, and stroked their hair in preparation for public speaking. While we get to know each other, Yao and Delilah will distribute your afternoon smoothies, said Masha. Such was Masha's charismatic charm that Francis hadn't even noticed Yao and Delilah stand up. Now they began to glide about the room, distributing tall glasses. This afternoon's smoothies were all the same emerald green color. Spinach, thought Frances with alarm, but when she took hers and had a sip, she tasted apple, honeydew melon, and pear, with undertones of moss and bark. It brought to mind a walk by a babbling brook in a dappled green forest. She tossed it back like tequila. Why don't you go first, Francis? Said Masha. Oh, okay. Well, I'm Francis. Hi. She put down her empty glass, dipped her head, and licked her teeth for lipstick. She realized she was automatically adopting her professional public speaking persona. Warm, humble, gracious, but a little standoffish in order to repel any huggers in the signing line. I came to Tranquillum House because I was kind of in a bad way. My health, my personal life, my career. She allowed her gaze to travel the circle. It felt strangely intimate, looking everyone in the eye again. I write romance books for a living, and my last one got rejected. I also got badly burned in an internet romance scam. So, why was she telling them all about the scam? Blab, blab, blab. Tony looked steadily back at her. He had more stubble than before, and his face seemed more defined. Men always lost weight so easily, the fuckers. She faltered a little. Was he sneering again? Or was he just looking at her? So, the first 5 days have been good. All at once, she was desperate to talk. She didn't care if she gave them too much information. The words spilled from her mouth. It was like that greedy feeling of sitting down to an excellent meal when you are very hungry, and after the first mouthful, you are suddenly shoveling food into your mouth like a machine. I enjoyed the silence more than I thought I would. It did seem to calm my thoughts. In addition to being rejected, I was very upset about this really very nasty review. I was thinking about it obsessively in the beginning, but I'm not even thinking about it at all now. So, That's good. And, well, I miss coffee and champagne and the internet and... Shut up, Francis. And, you know, all the normal luxuries of normal life. She sat back, her face warm. I'll go next, said the tall, dark and handsome man. I'm Lars. I'm a health retreat junkie. I indulge and atone, indulge and atone. It works for me. Francis looked at his chiseled cheekbones and golden-toned skin. It certainly does work for you, lovely Lars. I'm a family lawyer, so I need to drink a lot of wine after work. He paused, as if to allow time for his audience to laugh, but no one did. I always do a retreat in January because February is my busiest time of year. The phone starts ringing the day the new school year starts. You know, Mum and Dad realize they can't spend another summer together. Oh dear, said Napoleon somberly. As for Tranquillum House, I love the food, love the location, and I'm doing fine. I don't miss anything much, except for my Netflix account. He lifted his smoothie glass, as if it were a cocktail, and toasted the room. Flustered glasses lady spoke up next, although she was noticeably less flustered than she had been the first day. I'm Carmel. I'm here to lose weight. Obviously. Frances sighed. What did she mean, obviously? Carmel was thinner than her. I love everything about this place, said Carmel. Everything. She looked at Marcia with a degree of intensity that was unsettling. She lifted her smoothie glass and drank deeply. Jessica spoke up next, eagerly, as if she couldn't wait for her turn. So, my name is Jessica. She sat cross-legged, her hands placed on her knees like a kid in a school photo, and Frances could see the cute little girl she had been not all that long ago, before she succumbed to the temptation of all those cosmetic procedures. We came here because we've been having really very serious troubles with our marriage. We don't need to tell everyone that, muttered Ben into his chest. No, but babe, you know what? You were right when you said I'm too obsessed with appearances. She turned to look at him intently. You were right, babe! Her voice skidded up to an uncomfortably high pitch. Yeah, but... Okay. Jesus. Ben subsided. Francis could see the back of his neck turning red. We were heading for a divorce, continued Jessica, with touching earnestness, as if the word divorce would be shocking to all. I can give you my card, said Lars. Jessica ignored him. This noble silence has been really good for me, really great, really clarifying. She turned to Marcia. It's like I had so much noise in my head before I came here. I was like obsessed with social media. I admit it. I just had this constant chit-chat going on. She opened and closed her hand next to her ear to demonstrate. And now I see everything more clearly. It all started with the money. We won the lottery, you see, and everything changed and it really fucked us up. You won the lottery, said Carmel. I've never known anybody who won the lottery. We were actually going to keep that kind of shush, shush, said Jessica. She pressed her fingertip to her lips. But we changed our mind. Did we? Said Ben. How much did you win? Asked Lars, and then he immediately held up his palm. Inappropriate? Don't answer that. None of my business. How did you find out you'd won? Asked Frances. Tell us the story. She wanted the story of the moment their lives changed forever.
I'm so glad to hear that the silence has given you clarity, Jessica.
Marcia interrupted before the conversation could take a turn towards this exit. She had a remarkable ability to ignore what didn't interest her.
Who else?
Ben spoke up. Yeah, I'm Ben, Jessica's husband. Jessica covered why we're here. I'm fine. The silence has been fine. The food is better than I expected. I'm not sure what we're achieving, but it's all good. I guess I miss my new car.
What sort of car, mate?
Asked Tony.
Lamborghini, said Ben, tender-eyed, as if he'd been asked the name of his newborn son.
Tony smiled. It was the first time Frances had seen him smile, and it was the most unexpected, apple-cheeked smile. It entirely transformed his face. It was like a baby's smile. His eyes disappeared into a mass of wrinkles.
No wonder you miss it, he said. If I won the lottery, I always thought I'd get a Bugatti, mused Lars.
Ben shook his head. Overrated.
Overrated, he says. The most stunning car in the world is overrated.
If I ever won the lottery, I'd get a cute little red Ferrari, offered Zoe.
Yeah, well, the Ferrari is...
Marcia cut off the sports car conversation.
Who haven't we heard from yet? Tony?
You all know me as the desperado who tried to bring in the contraband, said Tony. He smiled again. Here for weight loss. I miss beer, pizza, ribs with plum sauce, wedges with sour cream, family-sized chocolate bars. You get the picture. His initial enthusiasm waned, and he lowered his eyes, clearly keen for everyone to stop looking at him.
Thank you, he said formally to the floor.
Frances didn't believe him. There was more to his decision to come here than just weight loss.
Napoleon raised his hand. Go ahead, Napoleon, said Marcia.
He lifted his chin and recited, It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul.
His eyes gleamed in the shadows from the candlelight. That's from Nelson Mandela's favorite poem, Invictus.
He looked uncertain for a moment.
You said we could recite poetry.
Absolutely I did, said Marcia warmly. I love the sentiment.
Yes, well, it just came into my head. I'm a high school teacher. The kids like to hear that they are masters of their own fates, although...
He laughed a strange sort of a laugh. Heather, who sat next to him, placed a gentle hand over his jiggling kneecap. He didn't seem to notice it.
Tomorrow is the third anniversary of our son's death. That's why we're here. He took his own life. So that's how my kid chose to be master of his own fate.
The room became very still, as if, for just a moment, they all held their breath. The tiny gold flames on the candles trembled. Frances compressed her lips so no words would escape. She felt as if all feelings were too big and unwieldy for her body, as if she might burst into tears or burst out laughing, as if she might say something overly sentimental or intimate. It was like she'd drunk too much in an inappropriate setting, a business meeting with publishing executives.
"I'm so sorry for your loss, Napoleon," said Masha, and she reached out her hand as if she wanted to touch Napoleon, but he was too far away. "So very sorry."
"Why, thank you, Masha," said Napoleon chattily.
If Frances didn't know better, she would have thought he was drunk. Had he got stuck into Zoe's smuggled wine? Was he having a nervous breakdown? Or was this just a natural response to the breaking of the silence? Zoe looked at her father, her forehead creased like that of an elderly woman, and Frances tried to imagine the missing boy who should have been sitting next to her.
"Oh, Zoe," thought Frances. She had suspected it might have been suicide when Zoe didn't say how he died.
Her friend Lily, who used to write beautiful historical romances, had lost her husband 10 years ago, and all she had told people was that Neil died unexpectedly. And everyone understood what that meant. Lily hadn't written since.
"Who else would like..."
But Napoleon interrupted Marcia.
"Got it!" he cried. "I know who you are," he said to Tony. "It's been driving me mad. Heather, darling, do you see who it is?"
Napoleon turned to his wife. Heather looked up from the empty smoothie glass she'd been studying.
"No?" "I know who he is," said Lars proudly. "I worked it out on the very first day."
Frances looked at Tony, who was looking awkwardly down at his glass with an expression of discomfort, but not confusion, as if he knew what they were all talking about. Who was he? A famous serial killer?
"Heather!" cried Napoleon. "You know him. I promise you know him."
"From school? Work?"
Heather shook her head.
"I don't..." "I'll give you a clue," Napoleon chanted. "We are the Navy Blues."
Heather studied Tony. Her face cleared.
"Smiley Hogburn."
Napoleon pointed at Heather as if she'd correctly guessed his charade.
"Exactly. It's Smiley Hogburn."
Then he seemed to doubt himself. "Aren't you?" Tony looked strained.
"Years ago I was," he said. "30 kilos ago.
"But Smiley Hogburn played for Carlton," said Jessica. "I'm a Carlton supporter. Aren't you, like, a total legend?"
She said it like there must have been a mix-up.
"It was probably before you were born," said Tony.
"Carlton is a football team, right?"
whispered Frances to Ben. She was very ignorant of anything to do with sport.
A friend once told her it was like she'd lived her whole life in a bunker.
Yep, said Ben. Aussie rules.
That's the jumping one?
Ben chortled.
They do jump, yeah.
Smiley Hogburn, thought Frances.
There was something blurrily familiar about that name. She felt her perception of Tony shift. He was a man who used to be someone, like Frances used to be someone. They had that in common. Although Frances's career was slowly fading away, whereas presumably Tony's had ended officially, probably with an injury of some sort. All that jumping. And he was no longer leaping about the football field.
I knew you were Smiley Hogburn, said Lars again.
He seemed to be looking for some sort of recognition that he wasn't getting.
I'm not normally good with faces, but I worked out who you were straight away.
Did you have to finish up playing because of a sporting injury? Asked Frances. She felt that was quite a knowledgeable, empathetic question to ask a sports person. It was probably something to do with ligaments.
Tony looked mildly amused. I had multiple injuries.
Oh, said Frances. I'm sorry to hear that.
Two knee reconstructions, hip replacement.
Tony seemed to be doing a sad assessment of his body. He sighed.
Chronic ankle issues?
Were you called Smiley Hogburn because you did smile a lot or because you didn't? Asked Zoe.
Because I did smile a lot, said Tony unsmilingly. I was kind of a simple guy back then.
Happy-go-lucky.
Were you? Said Frances, unable to hide her surprise.
I was, said Tony. He smiled at her. He seemed to find her funny.
Weren't you the one with the smiley face tattoos on your butt? Said Lars.
I've seen them, cried Frances before she could help herself.
Have you now? Said Lars suggestively.
Frances, said Tony, and he put a finger to his lips as if they had something to hide.
Wait, was he flirting with her?
Oh, no, not in that way, said Frances. She looked nervously at Marcia. I saw them accidentally. My brother used to have your poster in his bedroom.
It was Delilah, breaking ranks and speaking like a human being. The one where you're jumping 6 feet in the air and the other player is pulling down your shorts and you can see your tattoos? Hilarious.
Fancy that. We have a famous athlete in our midst.
There was an edge to Marcia's voice. Maybe she wanted to be the only athlete in their midst.
Former athlete. Tony corrected her. It was a long time ago.
So, who haven't we heard from yet?
Said Marcia, clearly keen to change the subject.
Post-sport depression, said Napoleon. Is that what you've got?
I've read about it. It affects a lot of elite sports people.
You've got to focus on your mental health, Tony.
Smiley?
Tony? I hope you don't mind if I call you Smiley.
You really do, because depression is an insidious...
Who's next?
Interrupted Marcia. I'll go next, said Zoe. I'm Zoe. She seemed to gather her thoughts. Or was she nervous? Oh, sweetheart.
As Dad already said, we decided to come to Tranquillum House because we can't stand to be at home in January. Because that's where my brother hanged himself. Marcia made a strange, startled sound and pressed her hand to her mouth. It was the first time Frances had observed Marcia show any sign of weakness. Even when she spoke about her father, for whom she clearly grieved, she'd still been controlled. Frances watched Marcia swallow convulsively for a few seconds, as if she were choking, but then she regained her composure and carried on listening to Zoe, although her eyes looked a little watery, as if she really had just choked on something. Zoe looked at the ceiling. The circle of people seemed to tilt towards her with the weight of their useless sympathy. Oh, wait. Dad probably didn't say that Zack hanged himself, but if you were wondering, like, what was his method of choice, that was it. It's popular. She smiled and rocked in tiny circles. The silver studs along her ears gleamed. One of his friends said that was so brave of Zack to choose that way to kill himself instead of pills. Like he'd been bungee jumping. God! She blew out a puff of air and her hair lifted from her forehead. Anyway, once we became like total experts on suicide, we stopped telling people how he did it. Because of suicide contagion. Suicide is really contagious. My parents were terrified I'd catch it too. Like chicken pox. I never caught it though. Zoe, said Napoleon. Darling, maybe that's enough. We weren't close, said Zoe to the group. She looked at her hands and said it again. Like, sometimes people think because we were twins, we were really close. But we went to different schools. We had different interests. Different values. Zoe, said her mother. Maybe now is not the... He got up really early that morning. Zoe ignored her mother. She fiddled with one of the many earrings in her earlobe. Her empty smoothie glass lay on its side against her thigh. He hardly ever got up early. He took out the recycling bin because it was his turn, and then he went back upstairs and killed himself. She sighed, as if she were bored. We took it in turns to take out the bins. I don't know if he was making some kind of point by doing that. It really pissed me off. Like, thanks so much for that, Zack. Good on you. That makes up for you killing yourself. Zoe, said Heather sharply. Zoe turned in her mother's direction, but very slowly, as if she had a stiff back. What? Heather took the smoothie glass and placed it upright on the floor, out of the way. She leaned towards her daughter and brushed a lock of hair out of Zoe's eyes. Something is not quite... Heather's gaze travelled around the circle of people. Not quite right. She turned to Marcia. She said, have you been medicating us? Chapter 30. Marcia. Focus only on your breathing. Focus only on your breathing. Marcia was fine, perfectly fine. She was under control.
For a moment there, when Zoe said what she said, Masha had very nearly lost her focus completely. Time slipped. But now she was back, her breathing steady. She was in control. This information about the brother should have come out in her one-on-one counseling sessions with the Marconi family. They had all freely said they were here for the anniversary of his death, but none had mentioned he took his own life. Masha should have seen through their evasive behavior. It was not like her to miss this. She was extremely perceptive. They had deliberately misled her, and as a result, she had been unprepared. She had felt blindsided. And now, this question from Heather. Have you been medicating us? Before Heather spoke, Masha had been observing the group, watching their mannerisms become freer, their pupils dilate and tongues loosen. They were clearly losing their inhibitions, speaking fluidly with refreshing honesty. Some, like Napoleon, fidgeted, whereas others, like Francis, were very still. Some were flushed, others pale. Right now, Heather was both, pasty white, with hectic spots of color on her cheeks. Have you? She demanded. Have you been medicating us? In a manner of speaking, said Masha calmly. Heather's question was not ideal and not anticipated, although perhaps it should have been, because Heather was a midwife, the only one of the guests, as far as Masha knew, with any medical expertise. But Masha would handle this. What do you mean, in a manner of speaking? Masha did not like Heather's tone, snappy, disrespectful. Well, medicating implies, Masha searched for the right words, a dulling of the senses. What we're doing here is heightening the senses. You need to tell us exactly what you've been giving us, right now. Heather moved up onto her knees, as if she were ready to leap to her feet. Masha was reminded of a ferocious little dog, one she'd quite like to kick. Hang on, what's going on here? Said Napoleon to Heather. Masha flashed a look at Yao and Delilah. Be ready if needed. They gave her barely perceptible nods, both gripping the discreet medical pouches they had clipped around their waists. This was not how it was supposed to go. Chapter 31. Lars. In his long history of health resorts, Lars had experienced some bizarre and unusual practices, but this was a first. It was ironic because one of the side benefits of coming here was to cut down on his recreational drug use. It's called microdosing, and it's perfectly safe, said their esteemed leader, who, as always, sat cross-legged and straight-backed, her incredible long white legs so entwined that sometimes Lars got distracted, trying to work out where each leg started and ended. There are multiple benefits, Higher levels of creativity, increased focus, heightened spiritual awareness, improved relationships. I could go on and on. Basically, you function just a little better than a normal person. The doses are about a tenth of a normal dose of LSD.
Wait, what? Asked Frances.
She laughed uncertainly, as if she'd heard a joke she didn't quite get. Lars liked her already.
Sorry, you're not saying that we've been taking LSD?
Lars saw most of his fellow guests were staring at Marcia with dull incomprehension. This was surely too conservative a crowd to cope with a revelation about drugs, even taking into account the popularity of cocaine in the suburbs. Lars himself dabbled with coke, ecstasy, and pot, but never LSD.
As I said, it's called microdosing, said Marcia.
It's called spiking our smoothies with a hallucinogenic drug, snapped Heather.
Heather. Before today, Lars would never have picked Heather as her name. It was far too soft a name for this skinny, tanned woman with quadriceps that looked like machine parts and a permanent, pained squint, as if she were peering straight into the sun. Every time Lars had looked at her during the silence, he'd imagined pressing his thumbs to the point between her eyebrows and saying, "Chill." Now he felt bad about feeling aggravated because she'd lost her son. The woman was allowed to frown.
"It's called outrageous," continued Heather.
She wasn't squinting now. Her eyes were ablaze with fury.
I don't quite understand, said her adorably addled husband, a long celery stick of a man, so dorky he was cool.
His name was Napoleon, which just added to his marvelousness.
Lars didn't think he was high. He'd been feeling great, but he generally did feel good on any sort of cleanse. Perhaps the doses were too small to affect him, or he'd built up a tolerance. He surreptitiously ran a finger around the edge of his smoothie glass and licked it. He thought about how, on the first day, he'd drunk his smoothie and said to Delilah, "This is so good. What's in this stuff?" And Delilah had said, "We'll give you the recipes when you leave." Lars had been imagining the recipes would specify the number of teaspoons of chia, not how many milligrams of LSD.
But, we're here to detoxify, said Frances to Marcia. You're saying we've cut out caffeine and replaced it with acid?
Tony, a.k.a. Smiley Hogburn, said, "I can't believe you've confiscated my beer and now you've given me drugs. I've never taken drugs."
"You don't think alcohol is a drug?" said Marcia. "LSD has been ranked 1/10 as harmful as alcohol. What do you think of that?"
"I guess LSD has no calories," said Carmel.
It was easy to remember her name, because Lars had a friend called Carmel who was also boringly convinced she was fat. Carmel's glasses sat crookedly on her face, but she didn't seem aware of it. She'd been mooching about for the last 5 days with that recently kicked in the face look Lars knew so well from his clients. the one that ignited a deep burn of rage in his belly, the rage that had fueled his entire career. He'd put $1 million on her husband having left her for a trophy wife.
Does LSD also speed up the metabolism? Carmel asked hopefully.
I really feel like my metabolism might be speeding up. I've never had drugs either, but I'm completely fine with this. I have total respect for you and your methods, Marsha.
Getting thin won't help you feel better, honey. Take the fuckwit to the cleaners.
Lars would talk to her later. See who represented her. I can't believe you've been giving my underage daughter LSD, said Heather.
I'm not underage, Mum, said Zoe. I'm feeling pretty good right now. Better than I felt in a while.
They're only microdoses. It's all good.
It's not all good, her mother sighed. For Christ's sake.
Napoleon spoke earnestly. Marsha, listen. I had a terrible experience with drugs when I was a teenager. It was a bad trip, as they say. One of the worst experiences of my life, and I always told my kids that's when I swore off drugs forever. So I appreciate what you're saying, but I'm not taking anything.
My God, Napoleon, you've already taken it, said Heather through gritted teeth. Are you not listening?
This is bullshit, said the lottery winner kid.
What was his name again?
A good, wholesome, straight boy name.
What was it?
The kid trembled with so much suppressed rage, it looked like he was having a seizure, and he spoke through clenched teeth.
I did not choose this.
His young wife spoke up. Ben is, like, full-on anti-drugs.
Ben, thought Lars. That was it. Ben and his cosmetically enhanced wife was Jessica. Ben and Jessica.
No chance these two had a prenup, and now there was significant money at stake if the marriage fell apart. They'd be the type to lose it all to their lawyers.
He doesn't even like taking aspirin, said Jessica. His sister is an addict, a proper addict. This is not good.
She put her hand on her husband's shoulder. I don't see how this is going to help our marriage. I'm not feeling very happy about this either. Not happy at all.
Her poor little Barbie doll face did look very unhappy.
Lars felt something unfurl in his chest, a deep, rich welling of sympathy for poor Jessica. Poor, poor little plastic Jessica. Confused little rich girl. All that money and no idea how to spend it, except on cosmetic procedures that were doing her no favours.
I understand your fear, said Marsha. You've been brainwashed because of the misinformation spread by governments.
I have not been brainwashed, said Ben. I have seen it for myself.
Yes, but those are street drugs, Ben, said Marsha. The problem with street drugs is you can't control the content or dosage.
I cannot believe this. Ben got to his feet.
LSD has actually been used very successfully to treat drug addiction, said Marsha. Your sister could benefit from it. in the right setting. Ben smacked his hands to his face. Unbelievable! Masha said, Do you know, there was a great man. His name was Steve Jobs. Lars, who had been expecting her to say the Dalai Lama, snickered. I always admired him greatly, said Masha. Not sure why you took all our iPhones away then, muttered Tony. Do you know what Steve Jobs said? He said that taking LSD was one of the most important, profound experiences of his life. Oh, well then, said Lars, greatly amused. If Steve Jobs said we should all take LSD, then we really should. Masha shook her head sadly at them as if they were misguided but lovable children. The side effects of psychedelic drugs are minimal. Respected researchers at Ivy League universities are doing clinical trials as we speak. The results have been excellent. Microdosing has allowed you to focus on your meditation and yoga practices over the last week, as well as alleviating the withdrawal symptoms you would otherwise have suffered by cutting out far more dangerous substances, like alcohol and sugar. Yes, but Masha, said Heather. She sounded calmer than before. She splayed her fingers on both hands, as if she were waiting for a fresh manicure to dry. The effects I'm feeling right now, the effects I suspect we are now all beginning to feel, that has to be more than just a microdose. Masha smiled at Heather as if she couldn't be happier with her. Oh, Heather, she said, you are a smart lady. That last smoothie was different, said Heather. Wasn't it? You are right, Heather, said Masha. I was about to explain this, but you keep racing me to the punch. She corrected the phrase almost instantly. Beating me to the punch. Her strong white teeth gleamed in the candlelight. It was hard to tell if it was a smile or a grimace. What's happening now is the next step in a rigorously planned and executed new protocol. She looked around the room, giving everyone tiny nods as if dispensing affirmative answers to their unspoken questions. Yes, 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 she seemed to be saying. You are about to embark on a truly transformative experience. We've never done this before at Tranquillum House, and we're all so excited about it. You are the first 9 guests to have this extraordinary opportunity. A glorious sense of well-being spread like honey throughout Lars's body. For most of you, your last smoothie contains both a dosage of LSD and a liquid form of psilocybin, a naturally occurring substance found in certain mushrooms. Magic mushrooms, said Tony with disgust. Oh my goodness, said Francis. It's like I'm back doing my arts degree again. Lars was so happy he'd chosen Tranquillum House for this cleanse. What a truly wonderful place. How innovative and cutting edge. But that's what caused my bad experience, said Napoleon. My bad trip.
It was a magic mushroom.
We won't let that happen, Napoleon, said Masha. We are trained medical professionals, and we're here to help and guide you. The drugs you have taken have been tested to ensure they are in their purest form.
Lovely, top quality, pure drugs, thought Lars dreamily.
It's called guided psychedelic therapy, said Masha. As your ego dissolves, you will access a higher level of consciousness. A curtain will be drawn back, and you will see the world in a way you've never seen it before.
Lars had a friend who had traveled for days in the Amazon to take part in an ayahuasca ceremony, where he'd vomited repeatedly and been eaten alive by bugs in his search for enlightenment. This was delightfully civilized in comparison. 5-star enlightenment.
What a load of bullshit, said Tony.
But I lost my mind, said Napoleon. I honestly lost my mind, and I did not like losing my mind.
That's because you weren't in a safe, secure environment. The experts call it set and setting, said Masha. For a positive experience, you need the right mindset and a controlled environment, like we've created here today.
She gestured about the room.
Yao, Delilah, and I are here to guide you and keep you safe.
You know you're going to get sued for this, said Heather serenely.
Masha smiled at her tenderly. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to move to one of the stretchers, where you may lie down and enjoy what I can assure you will be a truly transcendent experience.
And what if we don't want this experience? Said Tony.
I think we're all strapped into the spaceship now.
Lars nudged Tony's big beefy shoulder with his own. All you can do is sit back and enjoy the ride.
I find your smile very charming, by the way.
Oh, so do I, said Francis. I love his smile. It's like his whole head kind of crumples up like a crumpled tissue.
Jesus, said Tony.
You yourself are very handsome, said Francis to Lars. Devastatingly handsome, in fact.
Lars always felt fondly towards people who are unequivocal in their acknowledgement of his looks.
That's kind of you, he said modestly. I can't take credit for it. I come from a long line of devastatingly handsome men.
I feel like giving us drugs without our permission must be against the law, said Jessica.
Of course it's against the law, you twit, thought Lars.
Please don't call me a twit, said Jessica.
Lars's blood ran cold. She could read his mind, and she was extraordinarily wealthy. She now had the capacity to take over the world for her own nefarious purposes.
We're here for couples counseling, said Jessica to Masha. We paid for couples counseling. This is all just pointless for us.
This will have a profound impact on your marriage, said Masha. You and Ben won't be separated on your journey. You will sit together and experience this as a couple.
Masha indicated one of the clusters of cushions in the corner.
Your smoothies contained a different formula from everyone else's. We studied the research carefully, and we found that MDMA was the best ecstasy, snapped Heather. She means ecstasy. She's given you a party drug. Unbelievable. Kids die every year after taking ecstasy tablets, but don't let that bother you.
You're being kind of a downer about all this, Mum, said Zoe.
Let's go, said Ben to Jessica. He held out his hand to his wife and looked at Marcia. We're leaving.
Just hold on.
Jessica didn't take his hand. Again, when used in a controlled environment, MDMA is perfectly safe. It has been trialed for prescription psychotherapy with great success to treat PTSD, social anxiety, and for couples therapy, said Marcia. There has never been a single death or even a single adverse reaction to a clinically administered dose of MDMA.
This is not a clinical setting, cried Heather.
Marcia ignored her. MDMA is an empathogen. It produces feelings of empathy and openness.
It is a very nice experience, you guys, said Lars lovingly.
Marcia gave him a disapproving look. But this is not about dancing all night at a club. This is guided therapy. You will find, Ben and Jessica, that you become more sensitive to feelings and more accepting of each other's views. You're about to communicate in a way you've probably never communicated before.
Consent, said Napoleon. I feel like that's what's missing here. I feel like... I'm pretty sure...
He held up a finger.
I read the paperwork very carefully, and I feel certain we did not consent to this.
No, we fucking did not, said Tony.
Jessica stuck one of her long, fake fingernails in her mouth and chewed.
Careful, thought Lars. Those things look sharp.
What things look sharp?
Jessica frowned at Lars and then turned to Ben.
Maybe we should give it a go.
Ben, who was still on his feet, shook his head, his eyes fixed on a far-off horizon only he could see.
I did not choose this, he said again. Drugs are dangerous. Drugs are bad. Drugs ruin lives.
I know, babe, said Jessica, looking up at him.
But maybe we should just go with it.
I think you two should go for it, said Lars. I've seen a lot of bad marriages. But I think your marriage has...
There was a fine word he needed to finish his fine sentence, but it had escaped his brain.
The word swooped about between Jessica and Ben like a frisky butterfly before it landed, quivering, on Tony's hand. Lars leaned forward and read it.
Potential, he said. I think your marriage has potential.
Time slowed and then snapped back to normal pace.
Delilah stood right in front of him. She'd teleported herself, the clever minx.
It's time to lie down now, Lars, said Delilah.
Teleporting was a handy skill that Lars would like to develop. He would order teleporting for dummies.
He felt like that was the kind of witticism his new friend Francis would appreciate. But he saw that Francis was with Yao, lying down on one of the stretchers, trustingly lifting her head as Yao placed a mask over her eyes. Up you get. Delilah offered her hand. Lars was momentarily transfixed by a thick, lustrous curl of black hair that fell over her shoulder. He studied it for an hour, and then he took her hand. "I know all about bad marriages," Lars explained as he let her haul him to his feet. Delilah was as strong and powerful as Wonder Woman, and she also strongly resembled Wonder Woman. She was quite wondrous in many ways, although he would not let her near his hair. "Let's talk more about that in a moment," said Delilah, as she led him to a stretcher. "We can explore it during your guided therapy." "No, thank you, sweetheart. I've already done years of therapy," said Lars. "There's nothing I don't already know about my psyche." He thought of all those fat files crammed with pages of handwritten words about the great mysteries of Lars, which could in reality be summed up in a few paltry paragraphs. When Lars was 10, his father left his mother for a woman called Gwen. There may have been nice Gwens in the world, but Lars doubted it. His mother was screwed in the financial settlement. Now Lars spent his days eviscerating wealthy men who left their wives, an endless, pointless revenge fantasy against his long-dead father, a job which he found emotionally and financially satisfying. He was a control freak because he'd lost control of his life when he was a kid, and weird about money because he'd grown up with none, and he wasn't sufficiently vulnerable in his relationships because he didn't want to be vulnerable. He loved Ray, but there was a part of himself he withheld because Ray had had a happy, functional childhood, and it seemed Lars subconsciously wanted to punch him in the face for having the happy childhood that Lars didn't get. That was it. Nothing more to know. Nothing more to learn. A few years ago, Lars had swapped therapy for health resorts, and Ray took up cycling and got skinny and obsessed like all city cyclists. Life was good. "You haven't done this sort of therapy," said Delilah. "No, thank you," said Lars firmly and politely. "I'll just take the trip." Lars lay down and got himself comfortable. Big Tony, Smiley Hogburn, lay on the stretcher next to his. Marcia kneeled by his side, tucking him in with swift, sure movements like he was a giant, grizzled baby. Lars met Tony's eyes just before Marcia covered them with a mask. It was like looking into the terrified eyes of a prisoner. "Poor Tony. Just relax and enjoy it, big man." Delilah leaned in close to Lars, her breath warm and sweet. "I'm going to leave you for a moment, but I'll be back to check in on you and to talk about whatever is on your mind."
"There's nothing on my mind," said Lars. "Don't you touch my hair while I'm asleep, Delilah."
Very funny. I've never heard that joke before. "Marcia and Yao are here too. You're not on your own. You're in safe hands, Lars. If there is anything you need, just ask."
"That's sweet," said Lars.
Delilah put the mask over his eyes and headphones over his ears. "Look for the stars," said Delilah. classical music cascaded from the headphones directly into his brain. He could hear each note separately in its entirety with absolute purity. It was extraordinary. A little boy with dark hair and a dirty face said to Lars, "Come with me. I've got something to show you."
"No thanks, buddy," said Lars. "I'm busy right now."
He recognized this little kid. It was his boyhood self, little Lars, trying to give him a message.
"Please," said the little boy, and he took Lars's hand. "I've got something I need to show you."
"Maybe later," said Lars, pulling his hand free. "I'm busy right now. You go play." "Remember this," he thought. "Remember it all." He would tell Ray all about it when he got home. Ray would be interested. He was always interested in everything that happened to Lars, his face so earnest and open and hopeful. Ray didn't want to take anything from him. All Ray wanted was his love. For a moment, that simple thought was everything. It hung there, suspended in his consciousness. The answer to every question, the key to every lock. But then his mind exploded into a billion purple petals.
Chapter 32. Zoe's dad was refusing to lie down and put on his headphones, and those were the rules, but her dad didn't want to follow them. And that was the first time in Zoe's life that she had ever seen her dad break the rules. And it was so funny and awesome. Zoe carefully pressed each of her fingertips against her thumbs as she watched Marcia try to convince her dad to lie down. Her mum was shouting, "Illegal! Unconscionable! Appalling!" She was a savage little spitball of rage. It was cute. What did Zach used to say when Mum got mad? "Mum's being a savage cabbage." She closed her eyes. Mum is being such a savage cabbage right now.
"Thought you weren't talking to me."
His voice was clear as a bell in her ear. "I'm not. I hate you. I can't stand you."
"Yeah, I can't stand you either. Why do you keep telling people we weren't close?"
"Because we weren't. Before you died, we hadn't talked in like a month."
"Because you were being a bitch."
"No, because you were being a total loser."
"Fuck off."
"You fuck off. I downloaded your Shakespearean insult generator."
"I know you did. It's funny, right? Do you like it?"
"You pribbling, half-faced harpy."
"And I broke your electric guitar."
"I saw that. You threw it across the room." "You spleeny, milk-livered lewdster."
"I'm so angry with you."
"I know. You did it on purpose, to get back at me, to win."
"Yeah, no. I can't even remember what we were arguing about."
"I miss you every single day, Zach. Every single day."
"I know.
I'll never be a normal person ever again. You took that away from me. You made me abnormal, and it's lonely being abnormal."
"You were already kind of abnormal."
"Very funny."
"I think the parents want us over there."
What?
Zoe opened her eyes, and the yoga studio was a million miles wide. And her mom and dad were tiny specks in the distance, beckoning to her. Come sit with us. Chapter 33. Frances. Frances felt the soft, frosty tickle of snowflakes on her face as she and her friend Gillian flew across a star-studded sky in a sleigh drawn by white horses. A pile of books filled her lap. They were all the books she'd ever written, including foreign language editions. The books were open at the top like cereal boxes. Frances dipped her hand into each book and pulled out great handfuls of words to scatter across the sky. Got one, said Sol from the back of the sleigh, where he and Henry sat smoking cigarettes and killing off unnecessary adjectives with catapults. Leave them be, said Frances snappily. Let's get all those adverbs too, said Sol happily. Even the rhyming ones? Asked Henry affably. That's an imperfect rhyme, pointed out Frances. They're just words, Frances, said Gillian. So profound, Gillian, said Sol. Shut up, Sol, said Gillian. She never liked you, Frances told Sol. Sol said, that sort of woman always secretly wants an alpha male. Frances smiled fondly at him. Egotist, but sexy as hell. You were my first ever husband. I was your first ever husband, agreed Sol, and you were my second ever wife. Second wives are so young and pretty, said Frances. I liked being a second wife. By the by, Gillian kissed me once, said Henry, at someone's 30th birthday party. She was drunk, said Frances. Don't get a big head about it. I was drunk, agreed Gillian. I felt bad about that until the day I died. Henry, you were my second husband, said Frances, but I was your first wife. Therefore, not as pretty. Gillian said, why do you keep identifying your husbands? Readers get impatient if they have trouble working out which character is which, explained Frances. You've got to help them out. None of us is getting any younger. Except this isn't a book, said Gillian. I think you'll find it is, said Frances. I'm the protagonist, obviously. I feel like that tall Russian lady is giving you a run for your money, said Gillian. She is not, said Frances. It's all about me. I'm just not sure of my love interest yet. Oh, my God. It's so obvious, said Gillian. Blind Freddy could pick it, she shouted at the sky. You knew it from day one, right? Gillian, did you just try to break the fourth wall? Frances was shocked. I did not, said Gillian, but she looked guilty. I'm sure no one noticed. How tacky, said Frances. How very gimmicky. She dared to look up, and the stars were a million darting eyes on the lookout for rule-breaking in her story. Sexism, ageism, racism, tokenism, ableism, plagiarism, cultural appropriation, fat-shaming, body-shaming, slut-shaming, vegetarian-shaming, real estate agent-shaming. The voice of the almighty internet boomed from the sky. Shame on you. Frances hung her head.
It's just a story, she whispered. That's what I'm trying to tell you, said Gillian. An endless gossamer-like sentence, embroidered with jewel-like metaphors, far too many clauses, and meaning so obscure it had to be profound, wrapped itself around Frances's neck. But it really didn't suit her. So she wrenched it off and flung it into space, where it floated free, until at last a shy author, on his way to a festival to accept a prize, grabbed it from the sky and used it to gag one of his beautiful corpses. It looked lovely on her. Grey-bearded critics applauded with relief, grateful it hadn't ended up in a beach read. Will younger readers even recognize the term Blind Freddy? Asked Joe, who floated alongside Frances doing a line edit. She sat astride a giant lead pencil. Could it be ableist? What's interesting is that I'm a fictional character, said her internet scammer from the back of the sleigh, where he sat between Henry and Sol, his arms around their shoulders. Yet she loved me more than either of you. You're nothing but a scam, said Sol. She never even met you, let alone fucked you, cocksucker. Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, cried Joe. I agree. Delete, advised Gillian. My mother reads your books. As her loving ex-husbands, it's our duty to beat you to a pulp, said Henry to Paul Drabble. Scram, scam. Life is nothing but a scam, said Gillian. It's all just a giant illusion. Scram, scam, chuckled Sol. Good one. He and Henry fist-bumped. You're both far too old for fist-bumping, sighed Frances. But her ex-husbands were busy bonding. She always knew they'd like each other if they ever met. She should have invited them both to her 50th. She realized that Paul Drabble had vanished. As easy as that. There was no pain in the empty space he'd left behind. It turned out he'd meant nothing at all. Not a thing. He was just a credit on my bank balance, she told Gillian. Debit, you idiot, said Gillian. Debit, credit, said Frances. Whatever. I am completely over him. I was the one who meant something, said a child's voice. It was Ari, Paul Drabble's son. Frances didn't turn around. She could not look at him. I thought I was going to be his mother, she said to Gillian. It's the only time in my life I even considered being a mother. I know, said Gillian. So embarrassing, whispered Frances. I am so deeply embarrassed. It's a loss, Frances, said Gillian. You're allowed to grieve your loss, even if it's embarrassing. The snow fell silently for days as Frances grieved her loss of an imaginary boy, and Gillian sat beside her, head bowed in sympathy, until they were frozen, snow-covered figures. What about my dad? Asked Frances in the spring, when the snow melted, butterflies danced, and bees buzzed. Why isn't he here on my trip? I'm the one riding this thing, Gillian, not you. Let's get Dad on board. I'm here, said her dad from the back of the sleigh. He was alone, wearing the khaki safari suit he wore for Christmas lunch 1973, captured forever in the framed photo on her writing desk. She reached back and took his hand.
Hello, Dad.
You were always so crazy about the boys. Her dad shook his head. Francis smelled his Old Spice aftershave.
You died when I was too young, said Francis. That's why I made such bad choices in men. I was trying to replace you.
Cliché? Asked Jo from astride her lead pencil, which was bucking like a horse.
Whoa, boy!
Stop editing me, said Francis to Jo. You're retired. Go look after your grandchildren.
Don't even pretend you have unresolved daddy issues. You do not, said Gillian. Take responsibility. Francis pinched Gillian on the arm.
Ouch, said Gillian.
Sorry, I didn't think it would hurt. It's not like any of this is real, said Francis. It's just a story I'm making up as I go along.
Speaking of which, I always thought your plots could be better structured, said Gillian. The same goes for your life. All this chopping and changing of husbands. Maybe you could think about planning ahead for the final chapters.
I never had the courage to say that when I was alive.
You actually did say that when you were alive, said Francis, more than once, as a matter of fact.
You're always acting like you're the heroine of one of your own novels. You just fall into the arms of the next man the narrator puts in front of you.
You told me that, too.
Did I? Said Gillian. That was impolite of me.
I always thought so, said Francis.
I could have been kinder, said Gillian. I may have been on the spectrum.
Don't think you're getting any more character development now you're dead, said Francis. You're done. Let's focus on my character development.
You're easy. You're the princess, said Gillian. The passive princess waiting for yet another prince.
I could kill the emu, said Francis.
Well, we'll see, won't we, Francis? We'll see if you can kill the emu.
Maybe.
Francis watched the emu, alive again, but still incapable of flight, run across the star-studded sky. I really miss you, Gillian.
Thanks, said Gillian. I would say I missed you too, but that would not strictly be true, as I'm actually in a constant state of bliss.
I'm not surprised. It's so beautiful, said Francis. It's kind of like the Northern Lights, isn't it?
It's always there, said Gillian. What is? The Northern Lights? They are not always there. Ellen paid a fortune and didn't see a thing.
This, Francis, this beauty, just on the other side. You just have to be quiet. Stay still. Stop talking. Stop wanting. Just be. You'll hear it or feel it. Close your eyes and you'll see it.
Interesting, said Francis. Did I tell you about my review? Francis, forget the review.
Gosh. Gillian sounded quite cranky for someone who didn't have anything to do except lie back and enjoy the exquisite beauty of the afterlife.